Good evening, and welcome to the Higher Dimensions. I'm your hostess for this evening, Phyllis Pricer, with Psychic Worlds and Multiple Pathways in Washington, D.C. And tonight our guest is a well-noted therapist. He's an alcohol and drug addiction. He's a Ph.D. in hypnotherapy and psychology with Dr. Will Horton. Welcome, Will.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And you've written a couple of books so far, Will. I wish you'd let the audience know a little bit about those books.
Well, the first book I wrote was a book called Primary Objective, Neuro-Linguistic Programming and Guerrilla Warfare. It used mind control techniques in a thriller format, fiction. And then I've written two nonfiction books, Selling Yourself to Others, The New Psychology of Sales, and Hypnotic Selling Techniques. And then the book that'll be out soon is Mind Control, How to Get Others to Do What You Want.
Oh, that's lovely. I think parents all over the world would love to get that one.
Yeah.
Don't tell me that was your inspiration.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
I would have loved to have had that when my kids were growing up, believe me. At any rate, well, tonight I understand we're going to talk about addiction and how hypnotherapy is used to handle addictions.
Right.
And to help people cure from this.
Yes. To put it into remission.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, the clinical term, or the clinical world would say you're never cured of most addictions.
Right.
But you can put it into permanent remission.
Right.
And
okay.
I think hypnosis and neurolinguistics are wonderful tools to help people overcome addiction processes.
Okay. Will you explain to our audience again what neurolinguistics is? I'm sure they've heard of this, but it's always, I think, helpful to have another go at it and the explanation.
Right. Well, neurolinguistics basically is how your brain sorts and uses the information that you give it. It breaks down the processing of how your brain works. It's like the software. And what the cool thing about NLP is it works on how you do things instead of trying to find a why.
Okay.
One of the problems with something like an addiction, people will try to figure out why did they become an alcoholic or a drug addict or an overeater.
Right.
And you could spend years looking for the reason why.
Which is why therapists
never fix the behavior.
Right, exactly.
NLP is based, just like most hypnosis, it's a strong behavioral content, which is let's fix the behavior and worry about the why later.
Okay.
So that's one of the most wonderful things about it. And in the world of addiction, one of the ways to look at it would be your brain uses time in an interesting way. And what I'm going to talk about next kind of shows people how this would separate from other therapeutic modalities.
Right.
And why it would work. Well, your brain uses time much different than people think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us in the Western world have broken our past, present, and future down into little segments in our mind.
Exactly.
It's kind of like we have a past, you know, we know where our past is, we're in the present, and the future goes off to the side.
Right.
If most people would think about it, if they think about something they do every day, like brushing their teeth or combing their hair.
Right, and it's usually in a set pattern.
Right, and usually it's left to right. This is a big generality.
Okay.
And it's kind of linear. It's kind of like a U with the past off there. It comes kind of close to you today's, probably for most people, right in front. And then the future goes off to the right. Like I said, if most people think about, real quick, like brushing their teeth or combing their hair, and they think about doing it a month ago and get an image in their mind about when they were doing it, like getting ready for the holidays. And if they think about doing it today,
right.
And if they think about doing it, in a few months when the weather totally breaks,
right.
And then see all three pictures at the same time,
right.
You'll get a cross section of how your brain sorts and uses time.
Huh. Okay.
Now what's interesting about addiction, there's this phenomenon that we call in time, where you step into the moment. Performers can relate to this, athletes can relate to it, things like that. When you're in the moment, there's no past, there's no present, you're just in it.
You are.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're just there.
You're just being.
Yes. Yeah, and it doesn't mean you're not thinking, but you're just totally into it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and like you say, athletes talk about it. I always use the analogy of if someone's a good dancer, you know, they just dance. They don't think about it. They're just
right.
out there dancing.
Yeah, they just go into the movement and they're lost in the music.
Right, as opposed to, I call it the middle-aged white guy shuffle. He's barely moving on the dance floor because he's so busy looking at everybody else.
Right.
Right? And that's because they're not in the moment. Now,
right.
What's interesting about addictions of all types, first we'll break it down into alcohol and drugs, and this even works for gambling and sex addictions. And then we'll back up and talk at the end, if I think you wanted, about weight loss, because there's some of the same mechanisms in play.
Okay.
But with addictions, one of the things addictions do is it throws you into the moment. That's why alcohol is known as the social lubricant.
I see.
You have a couple of drinks, you're not worried about tomorrow. Even
right.
if you're a social drinker, that's when people go, I can stay for another hour.
Even
if you don't get drunk, the next day you're going, my God, why did I do that?
Right.
You know, because at the moment, you weren't thinking about any consequences.
Exactly.
And it's also why people say stupid things when they're drinking, things
right.
like that. So alcohol kind of throws you into the moment now, and so do drugs. And they do it artificially. You know, with the alcohol and drugs, what they do to your neural receptors. Anyway, so we kind of crave that being in the moment.
Right. right?
And the difference between a social drinker and a person that's crossed the line
mm-hmm.
is very simple. You know, a social drinker will stop when there's negative consequences.
Okay.
You know, if their boss yells at them because they're late, they won't do it again.
Right.
They won't go out drinking.
Right.
You know, I think it's possible to get a DUI and not be an alcoholic. You're at a wedding, you have one too many drinks.
Right, exactly.
But you would never, ever drink and drive again.
Exactly.
But an alcoholic would say they would blame it on...
whatever.
Oh, yeah, it was the cop's fault or,
uh-huh.
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So anyway, going back about how people think about alcohol or how people think about time, one of the things that happens when it comes to an addiction is even the thought processes about going about the behavior, drinking, drugging, gambling, sex, even food,
uh-huh.
when you start thinking about it, it throws you into the moment. So you have no idea of the past, you know, what this alcohol, drugs, or food has done to you in the past, and you're not worrying about what it'll do to you in the future.
I see. So it's just the existence of now.
Is now.
Okay.
And I remember, I personally haven't had a drink in 23 years.
Okay.
That's how I became an alcohol and drug counselor. I drank away two careers, a military career, and then I was an actor. And I kind of drank that away. And after when I started to sober up, that's what led me into the work that I do now.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, one day after learning a lot of this technology and traditional treatments and this and that, I was sitting at an AA meeting, and a guy was talking to a young guy who couldn't quite quit drinking. You know, the guy would not drink for, you know, 2-4 months, then he would go on a bender, as they call
right.
it, and then come back.
A binge drinker, what they call?
Binge drinker, yep.
Yeah, okay.
So everybody's trying to help the boy at the meeting, and there was an old-timer there that was not a neuro-linguistic programmer, was not a hypnotist, was not a therapist. He was
right.
a field worker. But he sits there and he says, because the kid starts talking, he says, I don't know, but the other day before I went drinking, all I could think about was a beer, and his hands went up like about 2 foot wide.
Yeah.
He goes, all I could think about was a nice cold beer, you know, with the frost on the mug and the foam on it, and it's running. I mean, even if you don't drink, you start getting thirsty when the guy's
running. I know. Yeah.
Right.
And I don't drink beer, and it sounds good to me.
and he leaned in, and he was totally, enmeshed in this guy.
Engrossed.
And anyway, when the old guy starts, he goes, well, son, first thing you have to do is when you think about drinking is pull back and see that drink for what it really is. And as he did that, he kind of leaned back and he took his hands from about 2 foot and made them smaller.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, you know, you got to see that drink for what it really is.
Right.
And then he goes, what you need to do is look to your past. Think about what happened the last time you drank. Well, the guy got in trouble with his wife and his boss.
Uh-huh.
Things like that. And he goes, then you got to look to your future and realize that your future is going to be just like your past. And what you need to do is think the drink through. It's a big AA thing. And I'm sitting there and I go, and I've been sober for a long time when I sobered up traditionally. And I'm like, that's the, one of the keys to it. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people don't learn how to do that.
Right.
So they never get the knack of not drinking.
Okay.
And I would say one of the things we can use hypnosis and NLP to do is, you know, take what works in the 12-step programs, and I just think 12-step programs are fabulous tools. I really do.
Right.
Especially if you come from an alcoholic family, because if you come from an alcoholic family,
mm-hmm.
you don't have any compass, so to say, about normal drinking.
Yeah.
So you may need, and what it's like to have, and the biggest way you can tell is if when you're talking, and I know when I'm talking to a client, and then they go, you know, they're from an alcoholic family, because they'll be the ones to say, well, but how do you have fun if you're not drinking?
Uh-huh.
Because they grew up with drinking being everything.
Right, exactly.
Okay? So anyway, jumping ahead to this, you know, if you look at what works in the 12-step program, the AA and Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and you synthesize that out, what you can use NLP and hypnosis to do is install that at a quicker level.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it can work with a 12-step program, because many people love 12-step programs. I'm all for them.
Mm-hmm.
But if for some reason you can't go to meetings or it's hard for you to get to meetings,
right.
you can still learn subconsciously the changes that you need to do
right.
To make sure that you won't fall back into the old behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, hypnosis and NLP is wonderful for ego strengthening, and a lot of clinicians, clinical psychologists would argue that, you know, addicts have a weak ego at a deep level. They may appear, you know, like an egomaniac, but
right.
underneath it, they always say it's an inferiority complex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Insecurity, what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah, lack of self-worth, all that good stuff.
What I think NLP and hypnosis is wonderful for is helping people break the cycle of addiction and get on to normal living.
Oh, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And,
because
and
most people don't like being stuck or being addicted to something, you know? They really, they get to resent it, I think.
Right. And it's kind of interesting. People go, well, how big of a problem is it? It's kind of interesting. This morning I was listening, since I knew it, going to be in a radio show, is listening to even more radio.
Uh-huh.
And there's a TV show that I think is on tomorrow night, and I think it's next week. It's called Armed and Famous or something like that.
Oh, yes.
A movie, you know.
Yes.
And they honestly became real cops. They had to go through the 8-week training program, and they became cops. And they worked, I guess, 6 months with the Muncie. I found out it was Muncie, Indiana Police Department.
Right.
And they were talking about a bunch of stuff today on the radio. And they all said, well, the thing that amazed them the most is the problems alcohol and drugs are causing people. You know, they hadn't seen it up front.
Up close and personal?
Yeah, like a police officer does. That 70% of the stuff cops have to do, is alcohol and drug related.
70%?
Oh, yeah. Domestic calls.
Wow.
Stupid things when they're drunk.
Well, yeah, I guess, yes. I'm thinking back to college days, and what the guys were like then, and the word stupid comes to mind. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I know when I, one of my first jobs in social services when I got in this field is I was an alcohol and drug counselor for the Cook County Jails in Illinois, right there in Chicago, and at Will County, Cook County Jails, and would go to the Illinois State Prison. And my unofficial estimate was about 90% of those people were in there for alcohol and drug-related charges.
Uh-huh.
It may not have been like selling drugs, but it might have been assault.
Right.
But if they weren't drunk or high, they wouldn't have assaulted somebody.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, and at least 10% of the people are in there, and they honestly don't know what it is they did to get them there. They don't remember it. They know.
They had a blackout, you mean?
Yeah, they had a blackout, which is another way you can always tell if someone's crossed that line from social drinking or even problem drinking
and uh-huh.
alcoholism is the idea of a blackout.
Okay. They seriously don't know what went on.
Yeah, a blackout is it's not passing out.
No.
If you drink enough and pass out, that's what you should do. But if you drink it, if you drink and you have a memory blackout, in other words, you function. You might have drove your car.
Right.
You might have carried on conversations, but you don't remember what you did. It's honestly not in the memory bank.
Right.
And they've tested this with, you know, deep hypnotic phenomenon, drug therapy.
Right.
And it's honestly, it's almost like you didn't hit the record button in your brain.
Yeah.
It doesn't get recorded, which according to most models of how your brain works, that's physically impossible.
Hmm.
And it's one of the reasons that the American Medical Association, the British Medical Association, listed alcoholism as a disease, because they can't explain why someone has a blackout. And those memories may never, they're probably not there. Because if you've ever been around somebody that's had a blackout, you think, you should be able to remember this. They honestly don't remember it.
Yeah, there's like a switch off between conduct and the memory of what one does.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone's ever had that, they've already crossed the line. Because that is, most people can't do that. And what's interesting is with alcoholism, especially, and alcohol is the most abused drug in America. Well, maybe caffeine.
let's be honest. Caffeine's up there.
And you're talking to a hardcore Starbucks guy. You know, I didn't give up all my addictions.
Well, you have to do one at a time, right?
Yeah. But the alcohol is one of the reasons I think it's so prevalent in America. Is there's two things going on. One is at a psychological level, Americans are very prudish.
Okay.
Right.
I've heard that. Yes.
I mean, we may act like we're all liberal, and parts of it, Hollywood and things, may be kind of liberal, but overall, we're rather conservative, prudish society.
Exactly.
As John Stewart says, you got to always remember this country was founded by people too uptight to live in England. The Puritans.
That's cute. I like that.
And they had the idea that that you should be able to just not drink.
Huh.
Drink like a man, and we hear things like that. Drink like a man.
Right.
You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
The real tough stuff.
And now what's interesting with that, on the flip side, American Indians do not have the genetic capabilities to process alcohol like Europeans.
Right, because it's not been a part of their culture,
It wasn't part of their culture. There's actually something in their liver where they don't, alcohol hits them faster and stays in their system longer.
Well, wouldn't that be because
and same with Irish have some of the same genetic things. And of course, look how many
Irish.
at least a third of Americans are Irish and Indian. I'm Irish and Indian. I was a DUI waiting to happen.
Well, you know what's interesting is I've got Irish and Native American in me too.
Yeah.
But I was told not to worry about becoming an alcoholic because I can have two drinks. Two glasses of wine and I'm three sheets to the wind, and I was told, don't worry about becoming an alcoholic, I can't drink enough to become one.
Yeah.
And they're right, you know, and I don't like the taste of it too, which is a blessing.
Right.
But I've noticed a lot of people, I noticed those who are in the military have a tendency to drink more. Is this anything that you've encountered?
Yes. Well, one of the things, the military is, what's interesting, almost every profession will always say the same things. We work hard and we play hard. Right?
Yeah.
I don't care. You get insurance salesmen to, all the way down the line, they'll all say that. But what's interesting about the military is it's only been in probably the last 15 years that they've started to look at the amount of problems it causes, and part of this, I think, is because the vast amount of money that the military has to spend to train somebody.
Right.
It's not like World War II, where you went through 6 weeks of boot camp, they gave you a rifle and you were out in the front line.
Go get 'em, boy.
Yeah. Now it's like even costs $250,000 per soldier. So they got a big investment in keeping people working.
Yes.
And for years it was drinking was almost covertly encouraged. And as part of what they did. And unfortunately, what we're beginning to see because of the war,
right,
is as people come back, they don't want to go get help, you know, for a lot of reasons. If they're staying in the military, you don't, if you ever show up for psychological care, it can actually damage your career.
Right, exactly.
And things like that. So they may be having flashbacks, can't sleep.
Right.
Things like that. So they start drinking to self-medicate, much like after, this is, that part to me is a replay of Vietnam.
Yeah, it sounds like it, yes.
Especially now that, and I've talked to people coming back, the amount of violence that they see every day.
And I think with also the wounds and the injuries.
Oh, yeah, and you see your buddies getting hurt. And,
yeah, and that's hard. It's hard to live with.
And then you have the survivor guilt because it wasn't you.
Yes.
And all this other stuff. So they come back, and all they're trying to do is maybe get a good night's sleep, so they start drinking.
Unfortunately, right.
Then what happens is the drinking takes over. You know,
yeah,
the old Chinese saying, a man takes the drink takes the drink, and the drink takes the man.
Right.
And that's what I see beginning to happen again. And I'm beginning to read, I guess, the VA is getting ready to to add more alcohol and drug counselors and try to get more mental
but
health.
The military is recognizing that, are they not now?
Yes.
They still don't use hypnosis very much.
No.
I would have thought they would have learned how valuable it is.
Well, and you know what's funny? Up until the mid-1950s, hypnosis was the treatment of choice.
Really?
They used to call it shell shock. Now it's post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right, yes. Right.
In fact, most of the psychiatrists and early psychologists trained in the VA, which the VA was the largest psychological training, it still is one of the largest psychological training, in, where more people get their, like, internships,
right,
is at the VA.
Well, I did some volunteer work when I was a teenager, which is, like, right before Vietnam, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, they were into shock treatment because I did the volunteer work over at the Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital Center here in D.C. And I know that they were not, to my knowledge, using hypnotherapy there.
No. Hypnosis fell out of vogue with the advent in the late 1950s, mid to late 50s with...
Okay, because this was about 55, 56 I did the volunteer work.
Yeah, it started to fall out because of the use of electroshock therapy.
Exactly. That's what they were using, and people did not look good when they came back, let me tell you.
Yeah, between that and psychotropic medication.
Oh, yeah.
You know, between those two, it was decided it was easier to shock them or drug them or treat them.
Right.
And so, you know, I know after Vietnam, for a while, they were beginning to use a lot of these kind of NLP and hypnosis techniques in treating post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And so hopefully, we're going to see that begin to happen again.
I'd like to think so, but so far, they seem, rather than seeing, which I consider hypnotherapy to be a basic, but they consider it an alternative therapy, and they still try to push pills, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
Rather than having people heal so they don't have to have pills.
Well, I think one of the reasons it may, you know, and for all of its faults, one of the interesting things the military does is a lot of cutting-edge research.
Yes,
and one of the reasons I think we may start to see it, and you're in the, you know, seat of power where you might start seeing these things start to come up, is, you know, if somebody comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan, and they've got some post-traumatic stress issues.
Right.
And they go into treatment. If you drug them, they can't go back to combat.
Okay.
You can't serve in a, at least to my knowledge, I don't think you can serve in a combat unit and be on antidepressants.
I don't know, but I would think that's a probability. But then that leaves our guys hurting.
Right. So, but if they treat them with hypnosis or NLP and get over it, if they have to go back on another tour, at least they're better able to do that.
Well, I would think that they would be more equitable just overall from that treatment, because it gives you an insight into yourself and it brings about healing from deep within, which is where all healing actually should begin, right?
Right, and you can even help them to psychologically harden themselves if they have to go back.
To cope with it, yes, cope with what they're going to meet, and because they can see it, and because once you move into the psyche, I think with at least my feeling has been that when you do that, when you get back into the, you're more intuitive, you're more able to reason and rationalize and work through what's going on. You're a damn better person, quite frankly, all the way around.
Right.
I mean, that has been my experience.
Right. And hypnosis and the NLP helps people, tap into that inner strength. And the other thing, I think we could do with it, if it ever got the chance, if it ever got the opportunity to be in a clinical trial, is, let's go find the people that come back from those horrible situations and adjust.
Yes.
And let's figure out what they did.
And how they
dealt. What alcoholics and drug addicts do and what works in AA. Well, you get somebody that understands the mental processes, we could figure out, okay, this is what you have to do to come back and be okay.
Right.
And then the guy's coming back to experience the problem. You can use hypnosis and NLP to help them
adjust.
Yeah. In a
positive way rather than one in which they self inflict damage. And because we're having guys commit suicide now coming back.
Right.
And the thing is, with this kind of counseling, it's confidential. It's exceedingly private and confidential, this kind of therapy.
Right.
Okay. And it works well. And you can do the same thing with pain management. They're beginning to use for pain, and God knows these poor men who've been injured so have need of something other than just broad painkillers that drug them all the time. It's absolutely fascinating to me, this whole subject. In fact, there was an article today that using vitamin B helps immeasurably with people who have, schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
They found that the use of vitamin B3 helped stabilize and even the sentences radically reduce behavioral problems caused by.
Yes.
How cheap and so simple is that? Is it a vitamin deficiency, for heaven's sake? Which makes sense because we're all chemically based and we do need a lot of the nutrients that we are no longer getting. But I think that's yes. So in your preambulations, you started clinics now. You're down in Florida, I think, right?
Yes, ma'am. I have an office in Port Charlotte and one in Fort Myers.
Okay.
Maybe soon in Sarasota. I haven't decided.
Sarasota?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So how do you get around all three of them? Do you fly or what?
No, they're about, an hour apart. So I
work
a couple of days a week in each clinic.
Okay.
And have other people helping.
So your recommendation for those who are having alcohol and other drug addictions, because I guess alcohol is a drug.
Yeah.
Is to have, how long does this program take and what does it consist of?
Well, I would say one of the great things about hypnosis and NLP, NLP and hypnosis, whichever way you want to word it, is you notice some changes rather quickly.
Okay.
And, it may take, I always say like six to eight sessions.
Okay.
Now, you may need more than that. You may need, twice as many or even three times that many. But you'll know if you're getting some progress in those those first six sessions.
Uh-huh.
So to me, that's one of the reasons I fell in love with it, is if it's going to work for you. And that is one of the, I can't stress that enough, we can help people rather quickly.
Uh-huh.
And so...
So we're not talking about months of therapy.
No. Now, you may need some boosters.
Okay, when you talk about boosters, you have what, six sessions, you say?
Yeah, I do six, and then they may come back for, every... Like, I always tell people, if like now, if you came in, and we usually get a lot of people starting to come in for, addictions and of course, weight loss after the first of the year, we'll get them on their way, they'll be cooking, and I tell them, you may want to come back for an extra session or two before the holidays next year.
Okay.
Because holidays is when people break out the alcohol.
Okay.
And the fattening foods.
Okay.
Right now, it's you know, it's easy to go on a diet. Everybody's going on a diet.
Exactly.
You know, so you may need a couple of little boosters, and that's okay. You know,
okay.
You know, and if someone wants to work with a 12-step program, if they find a hypnotist, neurolinguistic person that understands what the 12-step programs do, you know, it does. NLP and hypnosis isn't counterindicated with 12-step programs. It can actually help you.
Yeah, it boosts whatever you're doing, right?
Yes. Yeah. One of the things, like, if someone says, you know, I need to go to meetings but can't, or I have them look for reasons why they want to go. So then, you know, if they are going to meetings, they start looking for reasons to like it.
Okay.
You know, and if you started to do that, you'll start going.
Okay.
You know, why wouldn't you, right?
Right.
I mean, if you like to do something, you do it. So what we do, or what I do especially, is help people, help them, you know, make the changes necessary to give them the chance to get started on a life free of alcohol or drugs.
Okay. This is pretty phenomenal. This is pretty fantastic, as a matter of fact. And how is the success rate? How good is the success rate in this?
Well, I always say that, and not to sound like I'm doing a, since you're in Washington, the Washington two-step here, but success is directly related to how bad the person wants to change. And because if a person really wants to change,
they will.
They'll be much more successful at whatever they do, and hypnosis would probably be the best way to do it, in my opinion.
Okay.
But, you know, if someone comes to me, or I tell the hypnotist I train, that if someone comes and says, you know, and this is what usually happens, part of me really wants to do this. But part of me, you know, I like beer, or I like my food, you know, I like my cigarette. So part of me wants to and part of me doesn't.
Right.
And that's the person that'll do okay for a while and then fall back, do okay and fall back. Well, what we can do with NLP and hypnosis is remove that, it's a conscious-subconscious conflict.
Okay.
And, you know, because consciously, you know, you shouldn't drink or whatever the problem is.
Right.
Drink alcohol, you know, or
right.
Whatever it is. But subconsciously, you have some beliefs that are holding you back. You
that's
know,
correct.
Because in a subconscious, this is why it's so hard to give up some of these things, because a subconscious belief will override the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you grew up in a household where you heard things like real men drink, you should be able to control your liquor. Never trust a man that doesn't drink.
What?
You know?
Heard that.
Oh, yeah, I've heard it. Oh, yeah. I
really? That,
you know, yeah, yeah.
Huh.
But especially that, you know, you should drink like a man or drink like a lady. Be able to control your liquor, pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Oh, that's what I've heard, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
or,
yes,
you know, our family never gets help. We fix our own problems.
Oh, yeah, that's it. That's a denial.
Yeah, so those things, if those are some of the or if you grew up believing that alcohol is the only way to have fun, or food relieves pain, you know, or that you have to clean your plate, these subconscious beliefs.
Children are starving in Europe,
yes.
You know, if you eat, they won't.
Yeah, and these subconscious beliefs override all the best intentions in the world.
Okay, so how do you circumvent that? How does that get changed?
Well, one of the interesting things hypnosis does is they help go into the subconscious mind the same way that stuff was installed.
Right.
Right? Which it was installed when you were in an altered state, usually in childhood, growing up, and you were kind of, psychology would say, tabula rasa, blank slate.
There you go, okay.
And these things got in. Well, if you put somebody very relaxed and you're not challenging their beliefs,
right?
You know, by saying, by arguing with it.
Right.
Like people have a tip, well, you know better than that, or you know that stuff is killing you, you know that cake is bad for you.
Right.
Well, that doesn't work.
Right.
But if you have someone relaxed and you subconsciously help them see it differently,
right,
then it changes the belief.
Okay.
And people change beliefs all the time. I was talking not too long ago about that, and people go, but it's hard to change a belief. And I go, well, most people can relate to, in the Western world, that when you were a little kid, you fundamentally, in your heart, believed in Santa Claus.
Absolutely.
And then all of a sudden, like that,
yeah,
you got some different information,
yeah,
and it was just a cute idea.
Okay.
What if you could take that same process that you know how to do at one level, and
right,
let's say you had that idea like, oh, I have to clean my plate and food makes me feel better and that.
Right, right.
And it becomes a quaint idea that used to be true.
Right.
Then it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be a problem.
No, it wouldn't be a powerful hold on you.
So that's one of the things I that I love about, you know, hypnosis and NLP. So.
Okay. That's really something that I find absolutely fascinating, because, you know, I've, and you say that, what about the weight loss? We've talked about alcohol, but, and smoking. A lot of people don't want to stop smoking because they think they'll gain weight.
Right.
And many people do, and somebody told me once it was an oral fixation or something. They have to have something to do with their mouth, which is why they smoke and then they eat. But I don't think that holds true anymore. But that's an old thing I heard, my goodness, how many years ago?
Yeah. Well, I think we see that where people stop smoking and gain a lot of weight if they feel like they're giving something up.
Okay.
If they feel like, I'm suffering, I'm doing this,
yeah,
I'm losing my best friend, and then they go to eat to try to feel better.
Okay.
People, because one of the fact of the matter is, one-third of the people that stop smoking actually lose weight. And everybody
really
gets that. Yeah, because now, you know, in a couple of weeks, you start getting your wind back. You can,
yeah,
exercise.
Okay.
And so, you know, people, about a third, you know, lose weight. Of about 10 or 20% stay the same, and about 30 or 40% gain weight. But those are the people that aren't doing anything else. They're usually the cold turkey.
Uh-huh.
And they're just trying to do it on willpower. And so that ups the stress level.
Okay.
And so one of the things people do to try to relieve stress is eat.
Okay.
So,
well, dopamine is good. It makes you feel good. They call it comfort foods, right?
Yeah. And so if you, feel like you're giving something up, you'll do that. If you've done something like with a hypnosis program where it's like, I just don't want to smoke.
Right.
Why would you eat anymore?
Exactly.
You know, and so that, you know, and a lot of that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy also, or a reason why people won't even try.
Okay.
You know, especially, you know, when I work with people for smoking, especially women, I'm always saying, well, we want to do some stuff on weight loss because you don't want to gain weight. And they
okay.
go, yeah. You know, and it's so common, and not to sound sexist, because now it's even true guys don't want to gain weight. But a lot of people use that as a reason they don't stop.
I see.
You know, and it's almost like, well, yeah, you'll it might help you stay skinny, you know.
Yeah.
But you'll be dead. You
know? And it won't be pleasant.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to remind our listeners that they certainly can call in. I'm sure you'll be able to take some calls if anybody wants to call in and ask questions about the program. And for weight, someone said that I'm trying to think of the word. It takes longer. The therapy takes longer when you're going after losing weight because it's a deeper issue of some sort.
Right.
Is that correct?
Well,
yes, no, maybe so.
Yes, no, maybe so.
It depends.
It depends.
On the person.
Yeah, that's the only way to look at it, you know.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Because some people I know, it is abuse issues that they eat weight, that they gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
Childhood abuse issues.
Yeah.
Not necessarily sexual, though it can be.
Right.
Okay.
And a lot of that goes back to, again, how, like you said earlier, about where you taught to clean your plate.
Uh-huh.
You know, the message intended, I think parents are doing that. They don't want you to grow up and be fat. They
right.
They want you not to be wasteful.
Exactly. Well, I think that happened more when I was growing up. You know, you know, my stepfather came from Europe, and the kids, they literally did go hungry there.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the whole post-depression baby.
Yeah.
Because then, of course, World War II, there was rationing and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm talking about from that period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of it spilled over because I noticed, and I'm sure even your younger listeners, those in their like late 30s and 40s,
right.
will admit to this. How many times have you found yourself saying something and go, oh, my God, I'm becoming my mother.
Yes.
Or my dad.
Boy, isn't that the truth.
You know, and so some of that was just a belief, right?
You dad's a little fishes.
Right, and just like also with food, we're also taught to, many of us are taught, eat something to feel better.
Well, that's also, that's an old-fashioned thing.
Eat something, you'll feel better.
Yes.
You know, and again, it's one of those things that aren't true, but that seems true. And then now as an adult, you're angry, depressed, frustrated, upset, bored.
Mm-hmm.
You eat to try to feel better.
Uh-huh.
And momentarily, you might feel a little better, but then you feel guilty because you're overweight. And you're
right,
trying to lose
and you didn't really want to eat that anyway.
Yeah, so now you feel worse and end up eating more.
Because you feel worse.
Yeah, and then you say, the heck with it. I'll use radio words. The heck with it. I'll start tomorrow, or I'll do an extra hour on the treadmill.
Right, exactly. See, you've got the pattern down perfect.
Yeah. You know, I've been doing this stuff for 20 years, and So you need to change that idea that food
exactly.
is comfort, food makes you feel better. And I love when people say, yeah, but there's been studies that says chocolate does something good for you. I don't know what it is, right? But I go, well, who funded the study?
Well, the Chocolate Institute, probably.
Yeah, it was done at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, do you think they have ties to Hershey?
Yeah. And I'm not saying the researchers were unethical, but you give me $250,000, and what do you want this study to say?
Okay.
You know, I'll admit I have a price.
Hey, I love chocolate. What can I say?
Yeah, and so then it becomes something, and then people hang on to that.
Right.
And they'll say, oh, that's my reason. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know. But, only if it's a problem. If you don't eat, you know, one of my... And you've heard me, and you know you've seen me teach and stuff.
Right.
One of my big things is Cinnabons.
Cinnabons.
Cinnabons. The ones like at the airport or the mall.
Right.
Right. Well, I haven't had one, and I had one on my way back from where was I? Right around Christmas. Malaysia. I was in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur.
Uh huh.
Coming back in Chicago, I ate a Cinnabon. Now that's the first Cinnabon I had in 5 months.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
And I haven't had one since. So to me, I love them. Like some people say they love chocolate, but I don't go out of my way to get it.
You don't eat it every day.
Right. And I actually use it as a reward system because I hate to fly, and that's my reward for being at like O'Hare or Philly or one of the big airports. So you know you can make a lot of changes and not give up. If you know people go, yeah, but I'd never want to give up chocolate.
Well,
okay, but what if you ate it 80% less if you were eating a lot of chocolate?
I was just going to say, you know, moderation in all things is a really good byword.
Yep.
You know, a little bit of something, unless it's poisonous, of course. So, but we're not talking about something,
right.
You know, ridiculous. But a little bit doesn't harm the person.
Right.
And I think that's very important too, that we do reward ourselves and that we do tell ourselves that we deserve. We deserve to be a patted on the back and to reward ourselves.
Well, there was a book, I think it was last year, year before, and it was called French Women Don't Get Fat.
Yeah.
And or something like that.
Right,
Anyway, I was watching the lady talk, and she'd lived in New York for like 30 years and grew up in France and was always going back to France. But she made...
Okay, and welcome back. I'm so sorry we lost the signal, and we both got cut off the air. So, welcome back. We're talking with Will Horton, and he is a hypnotherapist and a PhD psychologist, and we're discussing hypnotherapy and addiction. But I'm so sorry, Will. The best laid plans of mice and men.
Oh, yeah. That
by the way, I wanted to let our listeners know we don't have too much time left on our show, but you certainly can call in and ask some questions related to the subject of hypnotherapy and the use of it, and whether or not it works in particular areas. Will is a wonderful speaker, and he does give clinics and all over the country. And but he is available to ask any questions. you give them some information on you where they could contact you if they'd like to follow up in
yes,
private?
Yes, they can contact me at the website, nsnlp.com,
mm-hmm.
or they can call 941-408-8551. That's 941-408-8551 or nsnlp.com.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Again, I apologize that sometimes things just happen that are outside one's control.
Right.
At any rate, we were discussing weight loss.
And I was talking about that. There was a book called French Women Don't Get Fat.
Right, exactly. There you go.
And what she talked about is how Americans feel guilty about eating food.
Yeah, well,
right.
We're so guilty about everything.
Right, and she talked about how, you know, because we're always looking at France because their diet's almost identical to ours, and they're skinnier than us. Well, first of all, they buy fresher food.
Yeah.
You know, the average refrigerator in France is about what we would keep in a motorhome.
Really?
So things like they don't go to the super centers and, you know, have like, you know, 9 months worth of food in the back room.
Really?
Yeah, they shop.
I was not aware we.
Yeah, they shop more like for a day or two.
Okay.
You know?
And well, that makes a difference too,
yeah.
I think.
So there's that, but then there's also that if they want to eat like pastry, they'll eat it and they'll enjoy it. They don't feel guilty about it.
Right.
And then if you watch Americans eat, especially American women, they'll be eating something going, oh, this is sinful. It's going right to my disc. This is going to make me fat. Well,
I can't help it. I see myself in that.
And not to sound, and I'm pretty metaphysical, and I'm becoming even more and more metaphysical and spiritual. If that's your energy when you're eating that food, that's what'll happen.
Interesting.
Where as opposed to, this is really good.
Yeah.
And you eat it, and then you don't even think about it anymore.
Exactly.
And you know, because this lady said, you know, she was just fascinated. She goes to France, and there's people, they're not, you know, their diet's a lot like Americans, their exercise patterns are a lot like Americans, and they're a lot skinnier than us.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah, and they're always like, oh, they drink wine, or they do this. Well, no, they, like I said, they buy fresher foods, they buy smaller amounts, and they walk more than we do.
Well, that I can believe,
you
okay?
Know, well,
that I can believe. I think most of in Europe people do, that's just generically.
Right.
I think we've become a rather lazy people,
well,
just overall.
It's finally proven that, like, New York, Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia, four cities I know of, where they have good public transportation, and if you live inside the city and use public transportation, you're actually thinner than the people that live in the suburbs.
Really?
Well, yeah, because in New York, I know Washington doesn't have all that great of public transportation. But because, think of New York. You've been to New York a lot, so have I.
Yeah.
You know, if it's within 8 blocks, you're not going to hop in a taxi.
Hell no, it's
too
expensive.
Yeah, and it's just 8 blocks. You're just walking.
Right.
And, you know, it's not
and
even
why
worth
would you take a subway
the, yeah,
it's eight
not
blocks.
Even worth walking down to get on the subway. So anything under about a mile, people walk. And so they track it. That people walk more in the cities, and because you go to the suburbs, I mean, just like from where you're at, go over to Alexandria, Virginia, and you know, you'll be in the mall here, and all you want to do is go to Circuit City, but you physically can't walk to it.
Well, that's true too.
You have to get in your car and drive.
Yeah, it's worth your life trying to cross the median.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I live here in Florida, where there is no public transportation, and there's a mall by my house. I'm not exaggerating. Where, you know, if you're there and you're shopping and you do say, oh, I want to run across the street to, like, Circuit City or Bed Bath and Beyond, you physically have to get in your car and drive. Because you can't, there's no place set up to cross this big highway. And if you think about the stupidity of that, you know, not just the fact of our oil addiction, you know, but the fact that, like, and then they wonder why we're getting bigger. You know?
Well, you know, I've been doing yoga. I'm very proud of myself. I've been very consistent for the better part of a year now.
Oh.
Hell yeah. And, but I still wish I could do more. In fact, I know I should do more. But then I had asthma. Listen to my story of complaint, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had asthma. And the more I exercised, the weaker I got. So I had to cut back until my asthma began to fade away, so to speak, because the more I exercised, the sicker I got, and the more out of breath I became, and the less inclined I was to do it, so it was kind of a kind of a rough spot for me, but I find now that I seem to be getting over that. But sometimes, it, especially for those who have asthma, which is a late onset for me, by the way, and a shock. But what do you do when you have a problem like that? I mean, what do you recommend? Does hypnotherapy help something like that?
Yeah, I've seen it help because it depends on which.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I've seen it help. I know one of the things is if there's a physical problem.
Right.
Hypnosis can help reduce, if not eliminate, a lot of the negative aspects of it.
Huh.
You know, I mean, help you.
You know, I had never considered hypnotherapy for asthma. Yeah, that's a thought.
Well, yeah, and it's almost like, and I've seen it like in a lot of areas, like myself. I mean, my left knee, I've got no knee left, I guess you could say, no cartilage. It's been rebuilt 3 times.
Wait.
Yeah, completely rebuilt. And,
wow.
And I do competitive martial arts.
Whoa.
And
that's
what
rough.
I use the self hypnosis for is, does my knee bother me?
Yes.
I don't hide that fact, but it's going to bother me whether I do something or not.
Okay.
And you know, if I keep my weight down and I keep in shape, my knee hurts less.
Right. Well, that makes sense too.
So if I'm doing something and it's hurting a little bit, I can use the self hypnosis to get through the pain to finish the workout, as long as I don't hurt myself.
Okay.
And you know, and plus in our culture, but the interesting thing about one of the things in our culture is people have started to mistake like being sore from a muscle
yeah.
workout.
Right.
And then act like, oh, this is terrible. No, that's
yeah.
what's supposed to happen.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I've noticed young people who are not used to exercising do this. I mean, I've had people come to start yoga,
mm-hmm.
and they never come again because they hurt.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, my God, when I was your age.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, it's one of those, you know, old fogey things here.
And real quick, I think it was New York City where they started to look at all these kids were on asthma medication, and then somebody came in and was doing a study and go, this is statistically impossible unless there's something wrong here.
Right.
And what they found out was, well, what would happen is if the kid would go out and play basketball, come back wheezing, couldn't breathe, because they were out of shape.
Uh-huh.
And so the mother would take it to the doctor, and the doctor put him on asthma medication.
Without really verifying.
Yeah,
that.
And so then, oh, and don't play basketball. So now it becomes self-fulfilling where they never got exercise. And I'm not saying that asthma is not real.
Well,
sure,
yeah,
but
I have
like,
to say.
You know, if you haven't played basketball in 3 months and you go out and you try to run up and down that court 10 times, you're not going to be able to breathe.
No, sir, I'm not. But in my case, you know, I went for months trying to think that it was just lack of exercise that was causing me to have a difficulty, and it wasn't until, you know, I was crawling up the steps on my hands and knees that I finally said, this is something wrong with this picture. I shouldn't have to be crawling at my age, you know.
Right.
So but then I didn't say that. I said, well, then what I'll do is correct it. I'll do more exercise, and if I exercise more and get better shape, you know, my body should respond to that respectfully and see if I can't get better.
Right.
And it has, but it's taken a little while, I have to admit. Of course, when
right.
you're a little older, it takes a little longer, yada, 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 you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know the drill.
Yeah, and for the people out there listening, there is a bunch of research on hypnosis for the treatment of addictions and behavior modification. Going back to some of the big ones, in case you have some, you know, people with OCD.
Uh-huh. Okay.
A doctor named Wohlberg.
Okay.
In 1948 used hypnosis in the treatment of alcoholism. One of the big ones lately was Orman, 1991.
Okay.
He did a bunch of research, and so did a doctor named Allen in 1995.
Okay.
And Allen found that one of the things hypnosis was helpful for in treatment of addictions, alcoholism, and it spilled over into weight loss,
uh-huh.
is its ability to reduce tension.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And we all know that hypnosis removes stress.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of your weight issues can be stress-related.
Exactly, exactly.
Because if you have stress, you have cortisol. Cortisol makes you put on fat. And
okay.
I know there's people that claim there's drugs out there to block cortisol, but that you can't. It's hard to block cortisol without shutting down the neurotransmitters.
Okay. I'm not sure if that was our signal that the that we have to end now. I think it may be.
Okay. Yeah,
but I am so glad that you were able to come this evening, and I'm so sorry that we got cut off the air.
Well, I don't know what happened. I thought
it
was maybe me.
It wasn't you, and it wasn't me, and it was just one of those things, sir. Okay. But I'd love to have you back another time. And meanwhile, I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Okay.
In the very near future. I think next week we're supposed to chat. And I thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. You've been listening to Dr. Will Horton, our guest for this evening on The Higher Dimension. I'm Phyllis Pricer, your hostess. We look forward to talking to you next week. We hope you have a wonderful week. You can reach me at MultiplePathwaysInc.com, that's my website, or PsychicWorlds4@AOL.com. You can call me at my office at 202-387-2080. And again, Dr. Horton, thank you so very much. You've been enlightening and entertaining as always.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you and good night.
Thank you. Good night.